Hey, I'm Alan McGuire.
And I'm Andrea Cleary.
And this is Juvenalia, a podcast where we talk to an interesting person about a bit of pop culture that was important to them when they were young. Our guest today is a writer, podcaster. Her newsletter, Step One of a Plan, has become a must-read for me and Andrea recently. We've been sending it to each other, so we thought we'd get her on the show. Miranda Reinert, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you. You have picked a banger, one that I honestly had not gotten around to ever. I actually was listening to it for the first time, I think, pretty much. I found a new album that I like, which is always very good for this. Mm-hmm. So please tell us what you've picked.
So I picked Plans by Death Cab for Cutie, their 2005 album, a record that I found probably when I was about 11 years old, I would say. At that point, several years after it had come out. Found this record, blew my mind. And to me, it is like the definitive record of me being like in middle school, particularly.
So how does an 11-year-old find Plans?
Sure. So I found Death Cab for Cutie broadly through a YouTube video that's called The Party Music 2. It's by a man named Mitchell Davis. And it's like a series of clips of songs and it's him and his friend like dancing to like a series of clips of songs. And there's a song off of Transatlanticism in that sort of group, and it's Title and Registration. And I heard that clip and I was like, that's the best thing I've ever heard in my whole life. This is the best song of all time. I never heard more than like 10 seconds of it. And so I go downstairs to my dad's computer. And I open up iTunes and I look to see if maybe he already has anything from them already. And he did. He had like most of the songs from Plans. And so I was like, well, this is the same band. It's not the same album, but it's the same band. So I just put all of those songs onto my iPod or the MP3 player that I had at the time and went from there. So half from a YouTube video and then half Plans because my dad liked Death Cab already and he had already bought some of their songs off iTunes.
I wish I had a Death Cab dad. I mean, I like my dad, but he's a Garth Brooks dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
My dad's a Pink Floyd dad, so.
That's a good dad.
Yeah, it's a good stepping stone.
For sure. My dad's more of a Steely Dan dad for the most part, but he's big into Death Cab. Right, exactly.
Yes, it's slightly different to my discovering of Death Cab, which will probably show the differences in our age, because I, like every other woman my age, discovered Death Cab for Cutie on the OC, because Seth liked them and they were his favorite band and he was my favorite boy, so I obviously had to hear this band. And I think I started with Transatlanticism, but I downloaded I Will Follow You Into the Dark, because again, I was a teenage girl, and that song just speaks to us for whatever reason. And I had that on my MP3 player, and it was a song I really wanted to learn on guitar for a really long time, but there's like, the chords were easy if I wanted to just strum it, but there was like a little picking bits and little hammer-on bits that I never got like around to learning. So this week when I knew that we were doing this, I was like, I'm slightly better now. I'll see if I can learn it. Vaguely. So I do feel like I've grown in the, 17 years since first kind of grappling with that, but not as much as I would have liked. So that's my... Yeah, that's my current state with this album. But I didn't listen to this album when it first came out. I think I was probably a few years after. Definitely Transatlanticism first. And then went back to this thinking it was the band's kind of like older stuff, before realizing that not at all. Just first record on a major label. But that's my history with the band. In brief, I think, yeah.
Mine is very patchy. Because I am again older again by magnitude from both of me. In my first like job, there was like a shared drive that had loads of albums and stuff on it. And Transatlanticism was on there, so this was like 2008, 2009. So I've completely fell in love with the song Transatlanticism. And again, like, it was a guitar thing. Like, I was just in, like, playing that do-do-do, do-do-do, because it feels amazing to play that. It really is just one of those little perfect little bits of music. There's like a perfect little 3 seconds of music. And then in 2020, I got obsessed with Obsess Your Heart, because I got obsessed with a playlist I made of songs with very long intros. And listened to mostly that in 2020 and nothing else. It was like 7 songs with very, very long intros that I listened to over and over again. And then never, and like, actually this is true of every song on that playlist, it never occurred to me to investigate any other music by any of the bands on the playlist. It was just those 7 songs. So come to plans now, and knowing that it slots in between the two of those confuses the hell out of me. I don't really understand the jumps between that. As soon as I listened to it, I did realize we had done Tegan and Sarah on here. And I was like, as soon as, what's the second song? Is it Something and Soul? Sorry, I'm terrible.
Soul Meets Body.
Soul Meets Body. I was like, oh, this sounds like The Con. And I was like, oh, because Chris Waller produced The Con as well.
Yep.
It's like sonically identical to The Con. It's really weird. But it situated me exactly in there then. So I did like it a lot. But yeah, how did you find, because it was interesting, Andre, you said that Plans felt older than Transatlanticism. Because I kind of feel like that as well. Transatlanticism feels maybe a little bit more timeless, whereas Plans feels more rooted into that couple of years.
It feels a bit rougher around the edges or something. I think Soul Meets Body feels a bit rougher around the edges. I think even, what else? Sorry, I'm different names for the same things. Like everything feels like very much in studio, just like we're recording straight here. We're recording as a band. It doesn't feel like it has loads of like bells and whistles, whereas I do feel like Transatlanticism, like with I Will Possess Your Heart or something, there's something kind of maybe a bit bigger, a bit like something that I think reading the contemporaneous Pitchfork review for this today, I think the writer of that probably expected something a bit broader, you know, a bit more appealing. Whereas this, like, they didn't seem to have changed very much from when they were kind of releasing music independently. But Miranda, you probably know more about like the switch in style there.
Yeah, I think the songs do feel a little bit in some ways like smaller. I think that like rough around the edges thing that you're mentioning definitely resonates with the way that I think about this album. Especially like if you're looking at Death Cab, like I was when I was listening to this record, or for a long time, kind of not going to the stuff before Transatlanticism. Because I actually think if you look at it in context of the records that come before Transatlanticism, like Photo Album and We Have the Facts and We're Saying Yes, I think it does make sense that Plans is after those. But I think the scale of the songs, which I think actually speaks more to the jump that I feel between the Photo Album and Transatlanticism, to me, that feels massive. That feels like such a just like the Grand Canyon between the feelings of those two records. And for them to only be a few years apart kind of like doesn't make sense. Like, but Plans, I think the scale of the songs is a little bit smaller. There's a lot more just like kind of, I don't know, like, which we're going to, I guess I'll get into, this is like a tough listen for me now. I think like some of Ben Gibbard's less impressive lyrical tendencies. There are some really like songs that I love. Crooked Teeth and Marching Man's of Manhattan are some of my favorite Death Cab songs, but like Your Heart is an Empty Room and I'll Follow You Into the Dark are songs that like just like, I don't know, when I listen to them now, maybe it's just because I've listened to them so many times, but it does feel like a little bit less impressive, less intricate, even compared to, you know, stuff that he'd done earlier, but also, and less, I don't know, specific. Because I feel like when you look at their really early music, so much of that feels really rooted in this very independent, very small scale, like snapshots of like a life. And on Plans, you get like intimate feeling that isn't, that's kind of non-specific.
Yeah, it's more conceptual.
Exactly. And I think for that reason, it doesn't work as well for me. And it does feel a little bit less formed compared to Transatlanticism, that I feel like even sonically is like really going for something more, something bigger, something, I don't know, less contained than what's going on Plans. I think that like tension is tough for me when I listen to it now.
I think when you listen to the first song, Marching Bands of Manhattan, like you could be forgiven for thinking you were about to listen to like a Bright Eyes album or something like that, like something really, what's the word? Well, that's sort of like a lot of brass and a lot of kind of jubilance, that doesn't really happen. And it's okay that it doesn't happen. It's, I think it's just my own sort of tendency to like hear or think about a marching band and think about Bright Eyes and think about the kinds of things that would evoke. I mean, I think, you know, it's telling for me that that is probably my favorite song on the record. And it's always sad when your favorite song on the record is the first song, because you're like, oh, where do we go from here? But I agree with you with I Will Follow You Into the Dark. I mean, I just did not listen to that song for years. And I reckon like within the past week, listening to this for today was the first song I'd listened to it in like five years, maybe a little bit longer, just because it was so, I don't know, that song kind of just took on something in culture. And it was probably partly to do with the OC. It was partly to do with being like a female fan of Death Cab for Cutie. It's partly to do with like the song being maybe the more twee song of their discography and like a very, very well known. And it just became this signifier of something. And I'm not quite sure what it is.
Well, like going back to Bright Eyes, it's a First Day of My Life.
Yeah, yes, well. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's where it's become a first dance for a type of person. But it is still, like, I'm only really engaged with this song properly for the first time, like in the last couple of weeks. And I'm like on the verge of tears every time I listen to it.
Yeah, okay. And
it's a fucking gorgeous song.
It's beautiful.
And I think if your partner went to a girls' Catholic school and encountered nuns and dealt with nuns, you're like, how is this song so specific?
I know. Well,
how is this about me singing it to my wife? What the fuck is happening here? You know?
Yeah. I do remember the second verse being very like important to me as someone who did go to a Catholic school with nuns.
And I think it's okay to be a little bit embarrassed by how earnestly you love something as a teenager and to distance yourself a little bit from it. I'm not saying that's exactly what's happening here, but I think that's what's happening with me, though.
I think it's partly the simplicity of the song. I do think the song is a really beautiful melody, but it's partly the simplicity of the song. It's ubiquity with the kind of, you know, Well, I mean, he was married to Zooey Deschanel, like the epitome of the kind of womanhood I'm talking about. But also, how earnestly I engaged with it as a teenager is probably something that I'm only now ready to reckon with as a grown woman, you know, and defend my earnest love for it as a teen, because it wasn't my fault.
Because even the album seems a little bit embarrassed about it.
Do you think so?
It comes after Busted. It's
different names for the same thing.
Different names. That's a big. It's almost like it's like they're like trying to do like a version of Letdown from OK Computer, and then they have that, and then it's kind of like, and then straight after it's
Your Heart is an Empty Room,
which is a little bit more bombastic again, and it's like it's just like it's almost like they're coughing after. It's like okay, Heart is an Empty Room, on we go. Like it's really just like we've written too beautiful a song. We don't know what to do with it. Here, just take it, and then we'll go on to the next thing.
We'll hide it amongst the guitars and the pianos.
Yes. It's tough to like think about music that, again, like you said, engaged with it so earnestly. I loved it so much. And it like, and then to look at it and it's, this like very twee, very cute, like, nice song. It's that's, yeah, definitely like trying to fight against the part of me that was embarrassed to have ever been like a 14-year-old girl who like wants to like be loved so much, you know? And it's such a pure and innocent expression of that. Especially because, like, do I think it is Ben Gibbard's most, like, my favorite Ben Gibbard love song? No. Certainly not my favorite of his songs about love, but it is the one that is, like, when I think about, like, oh, what is a love song? Like, that's the song that comes to my mind first. Like, still. If you were to ask, like, oh, like, what are your favorite love songs? Like, there's no way that song wouldn't cross my mind.
Yeah.
Which I think speaks to what Death Cab for Cutie is for me, which is like a band that I've always considered like one of my very favorites, if not my very favorite. I'm going to see them in the Postal Service this fall with my dad. Like, and you know, and it being this thing that that I like sort of with my dad and being like a big part of like our relationship. And his favorite record, his favorite of their albums is, he says he can't decide between Plans or Narrow Stairs. Those are his two, which to me is kind of funny. And like, I don't know. I think what you said about it speaking to that like teenage girl part of you that you're like trying not to be embarrassed of or not like, or just trying to like appreciate how earnestly you engaged with it. Is like sort of dead on how I feel about this record on the whole.
Yeah, I think as well there's like the other side of that, and I know we're spending a lot of time on I Will Follow You Into the Dark, but you know, we can't not.
How can you not?
but it's also quite an emo song.
Right.
It's about death.
Certainly.
And it's the kind of love that you think as a teenager exists. Mm-hmm. That kind of requires you, you know, that kind of Romeo and Juliet kind of love that requires you to promise someone like, I will die if you die. And like, and that level of emotion and just, I don't know, like, that level of emotion and feeling is so real and so true. And like the yearning to, it's not a level of emotion that you feel at that age. It's the yearning to have that feeling. And so this, if this song comes along and you're like, oh my God, someday I'm going to love someone as much as Ben Gibbard loves this person. And it's really emo, and the emo sort of like side of my teenage-dom is also something that I struggle to reckon with as well, because like if Death Cab is earnest, like the emo bands I was listening to were so earnest, and like, and I really was listening to those lyrics and thinking, yep, this is indicative of what my experience is. So I think it's like, yeah, it's a double-edged sword of being like twee and earnest, but also very emo, very like obsessed with death and how it relates to love. And that's kind of only something you think about if you're a teenager or if you're a grown-up who is actually starting to reckon with these kinds of questions. So I think like part of me is embarrassed at how much I was earnestly engaging with it without having like to think about it in any way. Like I didn't lose, like, you know, even grandparents or anything when I was a teenager. Like there was no death around me as a teenager, and yet here I was feeling the most about this song, you know.
Yeah, well, to that point, to your emo point, what Sarah said is even more,
yeah,
like to an even more direct degree. Love is watching someone die. I can't imagine
Benjamin.
how many like folders, like my planner in middle school probably has that like scrawled in it. It's like, love is watching someone die, and then who's gonna watch you die? Like Ben Gibbard, it really gets very emo and heavy-handed in such a funny and specific way.
And he was not a young man writing these lyrics. He was a grown boy.
It's a grown man.
Oh, Benjamin, who hurt you?
Which, what Sarah said, I think generally is a really beautiful song, Like it evokes such a beautiful scene of like being in a hospital and someone dying in it, but like not having happened yet, and that being such an evocative, beautiful scene that then is like, I don't know, it's a bit cloying, a little bit like to build up to that, like,
yeah,
so who's gonna watch you die statement. And it's it feels very teenage, very like, you know, very moving to me as an emo teen. But I don't know, I think that part kind of undermines the, it's almost like I get like kind of a chuckle out of that ending, that big build up to that ending. It kind of makes me chuckle because I think it's a really beautiful song otherwise. I think it sounds great. Chris Wallett does such a beautiful job on all of the Death Cab records. They all sound so great. Like everything he ever produced for them and everything he produces kind of broadly, I think has a really special quality. And he is, I think, so much of what makes Death Cab such a great band. Beyond Ben Gibbard's, you know, voice and lyrics and stuff, it's that feeling of, and the records feel really big, they always do, and that's, you know, to his credit.
Yeah,
but
I think that line, the who's gonna watch you die, it's the kind of line that kind of recurs with Ben Gibbard, and which is, I can imagine how proud he was when he wrote it. And and it's that thing of like, oh yeah, this is really gonna break some hearts, this is gonna hurt some people, and I don't mind that. That's not something that necessarily irritates me, but on that song, I think that's the issue I have with it as well, similar to you. It's like, ah, all for this, and it's just very direct and straightforward, but also just very like upfront with its theme. now we're stating the theme, and the song will end after however long it is, six minutes 20. So like it's quite a long song as it is, but I do think it is a beautiful song, like to just listen to, and I think it has a really lovely melody, and I think it sounds big and it sounds beautiful, but the smirk when he figured out that last line, I can't help but picture it, you know, and it's distracting somewhat.
It is.
You do wonder how like an adult man, I guess it's like can overcome like the cringe reflex when you write that down or try to sing it.
It was a different time.
It's like, you know, that Ira Glass thing with like the taste gap, where like you're right when you start off with stuff, you have taste, so you know what you're doing is bad and you need to get better to match your level, and then you have to like jump over that again and write stuff that, like, as a 30-year-old, you know, is melodramatic and like a little bit cringe and earnest, but still, you know, people are gonna love it.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's a
because I think this is like, if you were to say someone who's never listened to this album, if you were to put it in their hands and say this is a very melodramatic album, it would be true, but it would also not, this wouldn't be what would they would expect it to sound like. But there's so much melodrama on this. Mm-hmm. And it's, I don't know, like maybe Ben Gibbard is like, we should think of him more like in the realm of people who write musical theater songs, where it's just like, yeah, we're doing it. Like we're really, really doing it. But he has a kind of a talent for subtlety. Like to like illuminate the nose on their vacancy signs is, I think, just such a beautiful like lyric that evokes so much while doing like quite little, and it just slots in there so perfectly in that line. And I think that that's a really good example of him having the right thing for the right moment, and he has a lot of that throughout Death Cab and Postal Service as well, who I also love. But yeah, maybe, I don't know, was it a time when men got away with more in their lyrics? And especially men who have like quite a big female following, which I think it's fair to say Death Cab have like quite a big female following. I haven't looked at the data, but I think at least there is
anecdotal. Yeah, certainly. Or at least they have like also a reputation for that, I think, also.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, yes, I think at the time you get a lot of, like, kind of over-the-top sensitive man lyrics. I also think that, like, at this point, Death Cab and Ben Gibbard with the Postal Service, you know, 2003, both Transatlanticism and Give Up came out and are huge records. They're really, really popular records. So I think also, like, maybe if you're Ben Gibbard 2 years out from that happening, maybe your set, like, self-consciousness is a little bit like, you're just not as self-conscious about the words that you say, because so many people are like, I mean, you're riding a high, right? Like, and then he continues to ride that high on this record. Like, it's, I can, you know, I've never been that successful, but I imagine if I were to be that successful, I might be a little bit less self-conscious about some cloying lyrics.
Yeah.
If I was selling hundreds of thousands of millions of records, give up. Those records are so popular. Like, even at the time, yeah. I think Give Up is, like, Sub Pop's best-selling album since the, like, Nirvana's Bleach.
Really?
Yeah, it's second to Bleach. It's, yeah, 1.2 million copies
it's
sold.
So overall. Yeah. Successful. So, I don't know. But I do think you're right that they could get away with a little bit more at the time. Because, you know, like, what else is really popular? It's like, Dashboard Confessional got very popular writing the songs that he was writing. Not to betray that I really don't like that band, but, like, for someone who's quite emo, it's like, that was too much for me, even as, like, a 13-year-old. So it's, I think at the time you definitely could get away with a little bit more over-the-top drama, melodrama type stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, well, like, the emo boys were dragging the Over to Window on melodrama so far over.
Yeah.
That cat didn't seem quite restrained.
Yeah. And, like, my emo experience is very, like, mainstream emo. Funeral for a Friend, My Chemical Romance. I didn't engage, like, very deep in emo. But what I did love, I loved for exactly that, just, like, Boys with Feelings, which I was something I couldn't find in very many other places. Like, I didn't have the internet, so it was very, very hard for me to get my hands on some boys who were feeling things.
The Strokes didn't have feelings.
I wasn't there with the Strokes yet. I think I had to see some Strokes music videos to get it. And then I was in. I was like, oh, it's a whole thing. It's not just the music. And now they're, you know, remain one of my favorite bands. But yeah, the earnestness, I think, was a major, like, it was a selling point for this band, is how earnest Ben Gibbard was. And that sort of, like, non-threatening man with feelings, he was older than I was, like, by a good bit at the time, so he felt like, the band felt like grown-up music to me, in a way that a lot of other bands I was listening to didn't. And it's helped by, you know, dedicating an album to a concept of, like, death, or I think he said, like, the album is about, like, that idea of how do you tell a joke to God? You make a plan, and plans that don't go right, or, you know, like, very, just kind of at the time for me, like, quite grown up things. And looking at it now, I like that as a theme. Like, as a grown up now, I'm like, yeah, that's a cool thing to write an album about. And if it came out today, I think I would like it. I think. It's so hard to
me. It did come out this week, so I
yeah, it did come out today for you, Alan.
Yeah,
so.
yeah.
Is this the fresh new sound we've been searching for?
Yes. The con is back.
The con and Death
Cab. Things are sending to con. Yeah.
Miranda, when you were listening to Death Cab, like, were you making your friends listen to them? Were you the person who was like, you have to listen to this band, or was it like a personal, like, this is my band, they're my secret sort of thing?
Oh, I was always trying to get people to listen to Death Cab. I was, and all the music I listened to, like especially like middle school, early high school, being like, you have to listen to this. This is like the best thing ever. I've never really been a like, this band is my band type person. I've always been like super like annoying about everything that I like really like. I think I feel that way a little bit more with like movies that I like rather than music. Okay. Especially when I was younger, like really, really loved a movie. Like I didn't want to talk to anybody about it. It was like this very like intimate personal thing to be like loving. But with music, I was always, you guys have to listen to this. And then it leads me to like the embarrassing moments of like being like a really big Owl City fan when I was very young.
Oh my.
And then being like, and then hearing Give Up by the Postal Service for the first time and being like, oh, this is like the good version of that.
Okay, because I similarly, when I first heard Fireflies, yeah, by Owl City, yeah. I was like, I like what this is trying to do. And I hadn't yet heard the Postal Service. And my boyfriend at the time was like, I have an album for you. And yes. He gave me the first Postal Service album. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, no, I'm like, oh, yeah, this, me being like 14 years old and hearing it, being like, oh, okay, yeah, no, this is the good thing. This is the good version. And
yeah.
And then loving it from then. Mm. But but talking about Owl City for the previous 3 years and like,
yeah, LCD was in retrospect absolutely shameless.
Yeah, shameless.
Like it was, yeah. Like they just saw, they're like, okay, well, they're if the Post Service aren't going to do it, I'm going to do it. Mm. And I was like, I mean,
I guess
no, let it exist, my dude.
Yeah. Yeah, I think yeah, that LCD song is yeah, like, yeah, I don't know. Actually, I'll talk for 10 minutes if I start, so I won't.
For a while, he like denied listening to the Postal Service. I remember that vividly. He would deny it. And it's like, there's no way. Now he doesn't. Now he like, recently I read something. I don't know if it was an interview with him or if it was something else. But now he won't. He's not denying it anymore. But for a while, for years, he would say he'd like, he's like, I'm not ripping them off. I've never like, I never really even listened to that band. Like, it's just not true.
No. Like in The Office when Michael Scott is like, when I was 5 years old, I independently from anybody else invented a unicorn and I'd never seen one before, but I just imagined it. And it's like, okay, guy from Owl City, like you just. But yeah, that Postal Service record I loved. And I also, for similar reasons for not going back to Death Cab for Cutie for years, I didn't listen to the Postal Service for years. What is the name of that first album? I can't remember.
Give Up.
Because I remembered it being very earnest. And during lockdown, I went back and listened to it because I was just on a whole. It was around, I was listening to Fountains of Wayne a lot and around that time. And I was like, yeah, why not? I'll listen to this album. And I was just like, oh, I remember every single lyric. I remember every flourish. Mm-hmm. Like this is, I feel like fizzy with like excitement listening to this. And I think for me, that's like the sound of Ben Gibbard just like having fun, being a bit experimental, but like he really cannot stop himself just like making very sincere declarations of like love and how, yes, you know, beautiful the world is. And I'm like, you know what? I think that's just part of your character, Benjamin. And I think that maybe you're too soft for the world. You know?
I think this, like, the fact that he's such a distinctive lyricist is an achievement in itself. Mm. I think you don't get a lot of them. Like, there was CNN tweeted a couple of years ago. It was like, the chemicals in our bones and skin come from the gases of stars a million miles away. People are like, why are CNN tweeting Ben Gibbard?
It's true. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think the thing that the Postal Service connected with in me was in a weird way the thing that OK Computer connected with me. And I was like, it's feelings and it's robots. but this is if those two things come together and it works out instead of those two things coming together and it's bad. Yeah, I think it tickled the same part of me as some elements of OK Computer on a very surface level, just like sound, you know, based thing. But were you really into the Postal Service as well, Miranda? Well, you're going to see them, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I love them. A little bit older when I got into them, but I definitely love them so much.
I was in a bakery in Amsterdam last month and Such Great Heights came on and I was like, oh my God, I need a trigger warning before people start playing the Postal Service in public spaces. I'm just going to start crying.
Yeah, I was in a long distance relationship when I was in college and The District Sleeps Alone Tonight, like,
oh like, man,
you would get like so like, you know, 18 years old being just like so on the nose and
yeah,
but it's pure, it's nice.
What I always wonder about like openers like that and like the first song on plans, it's like do they know, does it feel like big and iconic because it's the first song on this album, or is there something inherent into how this song is presenting itself? It's like the very first, like that drone at the start of The District Sleeps Alone Tonight, just instantly I'm sitting in like a white Ford Fiesta in 2004 in Cork with my roommate, and we're driving to the zoo instead of studying for our final exams. It's exactly the
That's
memory.
Very wholesome. That's what Ben would want.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they must know, because I think Death Cab for Cutie does. They have a lot of really great openers, like Bixby Canyon Bridge, and like openers that like jump in, like they don't, there's no like real ramp up into like a song, even like The New Year on Transatlantic.
Oh, The New Year is great. Hits straight off.
Yeah. Straight off. Title track, Home is a Fire, all of their openers I think are really, really great, and great for the same reasons. Like they really just like jump into a song. It's never like the slow build song or like a or like really like a short, you know, little intro track. It's always like one of the biggest songs. And I think they have to do that intentionally, because it feels that way, I think, on all of their albums.
Yeah, I think so. It's all their songs are kind of like a bit of a statement of intent for what they're going to do. Like if there's a piano track later on the album, if there's an acoustic guitar track later on the album, if there's like song that kind of rocks a bit more later on the album, seems like they try and fit it all like an overture or something like early on, and it's like, here's basically everything you're going to hear, which is I think an effective way to kind of introduce your album. Yeah, I love like Marching Bands, I think is so good. Like when I was listening to this over the past week, I just really kept going back to that song. It's so, so good. Like, and it too has cloying lyrics. But I don't know. He really gets away with them on that track, because of how it works instrumentally. I think it's just so like big and jubilant and gorgeous.
Yes. It's bombastic. It's so big. And I think you can hide a lot of cloying, maybe clunky lyrics inside that. I think that's true of most bands.
Yeah
I mean, if it feels good to sing along, because at this point they are a band who are like playing to what, 5,000-6,000 people maybe a night,
gotta probably. be
So like these are songs that you want to sing and be in a crowd with, you know, which I think is important.
Were there bands that you discovered through Death Cab then? Did they lead you on down any kind of particular routes?
I think I definitely listened to like Bright Eyes, like directly because of Death Cab, because I think it's sort of like a, well, if you like Death Cab for Cutie, you'll like Bright Eyes, or, you know, all the same people like those things.
It's right there on the Last FM, like the first.
Right, exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Recommendation thing, yeah.
And then a lot of the like sort of 2010s, more like emo that I listened to, I definitely like got attracted to due to like a Death Cab association, like people writing about like Into It Over It, who's like a Chicago based emo guy, which I'm from Chicago, so I was going to listen to his band probably anyway, but that he got a lot of Death Cab for Cutie comparisons, and like that to me was like, oh well, I'll like this because I like Death Cab, and like if that's being discussed, then I'll, you know, I want to check that out. But I think when I was young, outside of Bright Eyes, because that is such a quick jump, I never really got into like a lot of the indie rock type stuff that was around Death Cab for Cutie at the time. Just, I think it's because I got into a particular subset of like emo and pop punk that was like a little bit incongruent with what Death Cab for Cutie is.
Yeah.
Because I guess, yeah, there is like an avenue where you go down, you're like all in on the Shins.
Right.
Yeah.
Stuff, yes. But then it's down.
You went. That's where I went.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I went all in on the Shins. Yeah.
Yeah. I just listened to the Shins for the first time the other day.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yes.
Which album?
We listened to it. So we did it for, I host a podcast called Endless Scroll, and we did a bunch of, someone requested us to talk about the Shins, so we did a bunch of their records.
Oh, wow.
It's like Wincing the Night Away, Oh Inverted World, Shoots Too Narrow, and Port of Mara.
Three great records. All
those. And yes. It is so interesting, like such a, what a particular moment in indie. And I think if I had listened to the Shins when I was younger, I would have liked them a whole lot more. I think like if I had really gone down, I think there is definitely a world where like I would have gone down that path and become a like entirely different individual, probably a slightly different individual. Let's be honest, not that much different, but like, it's like, what a, like 2005, all those new records come out between like 2001 and 2007, right? So that like such a particular moment for music.
Yeah, there was a lot of different things going on. And I mean, if you are someone who wants to get into the Shins during that time, you really have to sidestep Garden State.
And yes.
Again, a particular kind of femininity associated yes. with a relatively twee band who are, I don't actually think, all that twee. I think New Slang, you can definitely make the argument, but everything else, especially on Shoots Too Narrow, like it's that's just a guitar rock album. But yeah, you have to sidestep Garden State, which I managed to do, but it was hard. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like, you know, making Death Cab for Cutie Seth Cohen on the OC's like favorite band, it does so much legwork to like, that's like such a shortcut to a certain type of guy.
Yeah.
It's such a perfect way. Without, yeah, going full Zach Braff kind of weirdness about what's going on in Garden State.
Yeah, there's a way of doing that. And like,
yes,
Death Cab being Seth's favorite band felt to me as like a 14-year-old in Ireland, like I was like, oh, this is like cool little indie band who no one's ever heard of except for Seth. And like, there was the kind of allure of like alternative music that hadn't yet been available to me. Because a lot of what I think, Alan, you and I were talking about this beforehand, like we were listening to like the Libertines, and we were listening to a lot of like the UK sort of indie landfill stuff. And I use that term lovingly.
Super affectionate.
Yeah. A lot
50% of those songs, I would die for 50% of them. I hate.
Yeah. Yeah. But I will defend 100% of their right to exist.
But yeah, that whole American, because they're like, sorry, no, you shouldn't share a point. Yeah.
No. That's exactly what, like, the lack of access to a band like Death Cab for Cutie for us here when you're getting all of your music recommendations from like music channels on TV, like MTV2 or whatever else, or music magazines like The Enemy. Mm-hmm. And I imagine Death Cab were covered in The Enemy, but I wasn't like, that wasn't geared towards me they at that really, time. No.
Yeah. Like I was reading The Enemy then. They weren't really. Yeah.
They might've got got a short review or something, but they weren't like on the cover of The Enemy or anything like that. So like with Seth and his music taste, it was like this opportunity to listen to what all American teenagers were listening to in my eyes. <Of course. laughs> Because there was, that's who they were. They listened to Rooney, a band I still feel were fake. I don't know what was going on with Rooney and the OC. And they listened to Death Cab and The Thrills, which was quite nice because they're an Irish band. But yeah, it was such a shortcut for the kind of boy. And it was a kind of boy that was completely unavailable to me. Him and his music taste and his style of dress, like, didn't really have like preppy boys who dressed like him or anything like that. Not for another few years before that moment then happened. So that was all very exciting to teenage me.
Because I guess if in Ireland, any boy who was like a Seth Cohen meant that they had been to America and spent time in America,
yeah,
which immediately makes him another type of boy.
Yeah,
can never be just a pure Seth Cohen.
Yeah, yeah.
Because like I guess like all the like indie lamp and stuff we listen to is like it's geared towards, it's angular and a little bit bouncy and towards a dance floor.
Yeah,
whereas like Death Cab and like The Shins and like Tilly and the Wall, the Spinto Band, all those kind of, it's like anti bombastic music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's like emotional but not bombastic at all. So it's like, you can't really like both at the same time.
Yeah,
yeah.
Unless you like are a music journalist or a writer like you are, but like regular old schmoes like me could not hold those ideas at the same time.
It's like pitting your life on both the Libertines and the Mountain Goats at the same time. And it's like that is, it's unlikely that you'll have space for both of those things in your heart as a teenager.
Yeah.
You know?
And I definitely chose wrong. I wish I'd gotten into Mountain Goats as a teenager. Like, that genuinely could have changed things. But yeah, we are where we are.
Yeah. Is there anything we haven't spoken about with regards to this album, Miranda, that you want to talk about? Feelings are accepted and encouraged.
I think in preparing for this, I found that like I'm much too harsh on it, which means I'm probably much too harsh on myself as a kid, as a teenager. And I think that's like the thing that I take away most from a lot of the music that I liked at that time. And for some reason, this album more than the other Death Cab records that I loved. And it's made me want to go listen to other stuff that I really liked at that time and see if like I do hold it too harshly in my head. That's my last, I think my last thought on plans for today.
I think that's the last thought on plans. Miranda, thank you so much. Please plug all your stuff. Tell people where they can find you.
Yes. So I do a podcast. It's called Endless Scroll. We talk about music. We talk about the internet. I do it with three of my friends. It's great. It's fun. I write for my own blog, which is called Step One of a Plan, but it's just MirandaReinert.com, where you can also find zines that I've made there. I occasionally write for other outlets, but that's not that relevant. Most of my writing is done for myself through my website. You can follow me on Twitter at Miranda Reiner also.
Great follow. Andrea, where can we find you?
You can find me over on the Nile and Nine podcast, weekly talking about music. You can also find me, you can find me on Blue Sky. I'm not plugging Twitter anymore. I'm done. But I am on Twitter. And you can read my newsletter, andrea-cleary.ghost.io, but I've fixed it so that andreacleary.com redirects to it. So andreacleary.com.
Yes.
That's me.
No, yeah. Women in STEM.
And yeah. You, Alan?
I'm Alan_McGuire most places. I sign up to all of them and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Juvenalia is juvenalia_pod on Twitter, juvenalia pod on Instagram. That's it for now. We have Patreon, patreon.com/juvenilia, where we do bonus episodes where we talk about what we started and finished recently. By the time this comes out, we will have had one where me and Sarah talk about Tears of the Kingdom. Very important
work being done.
Finally, yeah. Thank you, Dean McDonald, for our artwork. Thank you to Cassie Taltes for having us.
Thanks, Dean.
And thank you again to Miranda Reinhardt for bringing fans into my life.
Thank you, Miranda.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you.